Thus, a fox caught a gopher in a meadow, carrying X uphill to his bed on the brow of a ledge, where an eagle laid him low. The dying fox sensed the end of his chapter in foxdom, but not the new beginning in the odyssey of an atom. An Indian eventually inherited the eagle's plumes, and with them propitiated the fates, whom he assumed had a special interest in Indians. It did not occur to him that they might be busy casting dice against gravity, that mice and men, soils and songs, might be merely ways to retard the march of atoms to the sea. One year, while X lay in a cottonwood by the river, he was eaten by a beaver, an animal that always feeds higher than he dies. The beaver starved when his pond dried up during a bitter frost. X rode the carcass down the spring freshet, losing more altitude each hour than heretofore in a century. He ended up in the silt of a backwater bayou, where he fed a crayfish, a coon, and then an Indian, who laid him down to his last sleep in a mound on the riverbank. One spring, an oxbow caved the bank, and after one short week of freshet, X lay again in his ancient prison, the sea. An atom at large in the biota is too free to know freedom. An atom back in the sea has forgotten it. For every atom lost to the sea, the prairie pulls another out of the decaying rocks. The only certain truth is that its creatures must suck hard, live fast, and die often, lest its losses exceed its gains. It is the nature of roots to nose into cracks. When Y was thus released from the parent ledge, a new animal had arrived and begun redding up the prairie to fit his own notions of law and order. An ox team turned the prairie sod, and Y began a succession of dizzy annual trips through a new grass called wheat. The old prairie lived by the diversity of its plants and animals, all of which were useful because the sum total of their cooperations and competitions achieved continuity. But the wheat farmer was a builder of categories. To him, only wheat and oxen were useful. He saw the useless pigeons settle in clouds upon his wheat, and shortly cleared the skies of them. He saw the cinch bug take over the stealing job, and fumed because here was a useless thing too small to kill. He failed to see the downward wash of over-weeded loam, laid bare in spring against the pelting rains. When soil wash and cinch bugs finally put an end to wheat farming, Y and his like had already traveled far down the watershed. When the empire of wheat collapsed, the settler took a leaf from the old prairie book. He impounded his fertility in livestock. He augmented it with nitrogen-pumping alfalfa, and he tapped the lower layers of the loam with deep-rooted corn. But he used his alfalfa and every other new weapon against the wash, not only to hold his old plowings, but also to exploit new ones, which, in turn, needed holding. So, despite alfalfa, the black loam grew gradually thinner. Erosion engineers built dams and terraces to hold it. Army engineers built levees and wing dams to flush it from the rivers. The rivers would not flush, but raised their beds instead, thus choking navigation. So the engineers built pools like gigantic beaver ponds, and Y landed in one of these, his trip from rock to river completed in one short century. On first reaching the pool, Y made several trips through water plants, fish, and waterfowl. But engineers build sewers as well as dams, and down them comes the loot of all the far hills and the sea. The atoms that once grew paskflowers to greet the returning plovers now lie inert, confused, imprisoned in oily sludge. Roots still nose among the rocks. Rain still pelt the fields. Deer mice still hide their souvenirs of Indian summer. Old men who helped destroy the pigeons still recount the glory of the fluttering hosts. Black and white buffalo pass in and out of red barns, offering free rides to itinerant atoms. On a monument to the pigeon. We have erected a monument to commemorate the funeral of a species. It symbolizes our sorrow. We grieve because no living man will see again the onrushing phalanx of victorious birds, sweeping a path for spring across the March skies, chasing the defeated winter from all the woods and prairies of Wisconsin. Men still live who, in their youth, remember pigeons. Trees still live who, in their youth, were shaken by a living wind. But a decade hence, only the eldest oaks will remember, and at long last, only the hills will know. There will always be pigeons in books and in museums, but these are effigies and images, dead to all hardships and to all delights. Book pigeons cannot dive out of a cloud to make the deer run for cover, or clap their wings in thunderous applause of mast-laden woods. Book pigeons cannot breakfast on new-mown wheat in Minnesota and dine on blueberries in Canada. They know no urge of seasons. They feel no kiss of sun, no lash of wind and weather. They live forever by not living at all. Our grandfathers were less well-housed, well-fed, well-clothed than we are. The strivings by which they bettered their lot are also those which deprived us of pigeons. Perhaps we now grieve because we are not sure, in our hearts, that we have gained by the exchange. The gadgets of industry bring us more comforts than the pigeons did, but do they add as much to the glory of the spring? It is a century now since Darwin gave us the first glimpse of the origin of species. We now know what was unknown to all the preceding caravan of generations, that men are only fellow voyagers with other creatures in the odyssey of evolution. This new knowledge should have given us, by this time, a sense of kinship with fellow creatures, a wish to live and let live, a sense of wonder over the magnitude and duration of the biotic enterprise. Above all, we should, in the centuries since Darwin, have come to know that man, while now captain of the adventuring ship, is hardly the sole object of its quest, and that his prior assumptions to this effect arose from the simple necessity of whistling in the dark. These things, I say, should have come to us. I fear they have not come to many. For one species to mourn the death of another is a new thing under the sun. The Cro-Magnon who slew the last mammoth thought only of stakes. The sportsman who shot the last pigeon thought only of his prowess. The sailor who clubbed the last auk thought of nothing at all. But we, who have lost our pigeons, mourn the loss. Had the funeral been ours, the pigeons would hardly have mourned us. In this fact, rather than in Mr. DuPont's nylons or Mr. Vannevar Bush's bombs, lies objective evidence of our superiority over the beasts. This monument, perched like a duck hawk on this cliff, will scan this wide valley, watching through the days and years. For many a march, it will watch the geese go by, telling the river about clearer, colder, lonelier waters on the tundra. For many an April, it will see the redbuds come and go. And for many a May, the flush of oak blooms on a thousand hills. Questing wood ducks will search these basswoods for hollow limbs. Golden prothonotaries will shake golden pollen from the river willows. Egrets will pose on these sloughs in August. Plovers will whistle from September skies. Hickory nuts will plop into October leaves, and hail will rattle in November woods. But no pigeons will pass, for there are no pigeons, save only this flightless one, graven in bronze on this rock. Tourists will read this inscription, but their thoughts will not take wing. We are told by economic moralists that to mourn the pigeon is mere nostalgia, that if the pigeoners had not done away with him, the farmers would ultimately have been obliged, in self-defense, to do so. This is one of those peculiar truths that are valid, but not for the reasons alleged. The pigeon was a biological storm. He was the lightning that played between two opposing potentials of intolerable intensity, the fat of the land and the oxygen of the air. Yearly, the feathered tempest roared up and down and across the continent, sucking up the laden fruits of forest and prairie, burning them in a traveling blast of life. Like any other chain reaction, the pigeon could survive no diminution of his own furious intensity. When the pigeoners subtracted from his numbers, and the pioneers chopped gaps in the continuity of his fuel, his flame guttered out with hardly a sputter or even a wisp of smoke. Today the oaks still flaunt their burden at the sky, but the feathered lightning is no more. Worm and weevil must now perform slowly and silently the biological task that once drew thunder from the firmament. The wonder is not that the pigeon went out, but that he ever survived through all the millennia of pre-Babidian time. The pigeon loved his land. He lived by the intensity of his desire for clustered grape and bursting beechnut, and by his contempt of miles and seasons. Whatever Wisconsin did not offer him gratis today, he sought and found tomorrow in Michigan, or Labrador, or Tennessee. His love was for present things, and these things were present somewhere. To find them required only the free sky and the will to ply his wings. To love what was is a new thing under the sun, unknown to most people and to all pigeons. To see America as history, to conceive of destiny as a becoming, to smell a hickory tree through the still lapse of ages. All these things are possible for us, and to achieve them takes only the free sky and the will to ply our wings. In these things, and not in Mr. Bush's bombs and Mr. DuPont's nylons, lies objective evidence of our superiority over the beasts. Flambeau. People who have never canoed a wild river, or who have done so only with a guide in the stern, are apt to assume that novelty, plus healthful exercise, account for the value of the trip. I thought so too, until I met the two college boys on the Flambeau. Supper dishes washed, sat on the bank watching a buck dunking for water plants on the far shore. Soon the buck raised his head, cocked his ears upstream, and then bounded for cover. Around the bend now came the cause of his alarm, two boys in a canoe. Spying us, they edged in to pass the time of day. "What time is it?" was their first question. They explained that their watches had run down, and for the first time in their lives, there was no clock, whistle, or radio to set watches by. For 2 days they had lived by sun time, and were getting a thrill out of it. No servants brought them meals. They got their meat out of the river, or went without. No traffic cop whistled them off the hidden rock in the next rapids. No friendly roof kept them dry when they misguessed whether or not to pitch the tent. No guide showed them which camping spots offered a night-long breeze, and which a night-long misery of mosquitoes, which firewood made clean coals, and which only smoke. Before our young adventurers pushed off downstream, we learned that both were slated for the army upon the conclusion of their trip. Now the motif was clear. This trip was their first and last taste of freedom, an interlude between two regimentations, the campus and the barracks. The elemental simplicities of wilderness travel were thrills not only because of their novelty, but because they represented complete freedom to make mistakes. The wilderness gave them their first taste of those rewards and penalties for wise and foolish acts which every woodsman faces daily, but against which civilization has built 1,000 buffers. These boys were on their own in this particular sense. Perhaps every youth needs an occasional wilderness trip in order to learn the meaning of this particular freedom. When I was a small boy, my father used to describe all choice camps, fishing waters, and woods as nearly as good as the Flambeau. When I finally launched my own canoe in this legendary stream, I found it up to expectations as a river, but as a wilderness, it was on its last legs. New cottages, resorts, and highway bridges were chopping up the wild stretches into shorter and shorter segments. To run down the Flambeau was to be mentally whipsawed between alternating impressions. No sooner had you built up the mental illusion of being in the wilds than you sighted a boat landing, and soon you were coasting past some cottager's peonies. Safely past the peonies, a buck bounding up the bank helped us to restore the wilderness flavor. and the next rapids finished the job. But staring at you beside the pool below was a synthetic log cabin, complete with composition roof, bide-a-wee signboard, and rustic pergola for afternoon bridge. Paul Bunyan was too busy a man to think about posterity, but if he had asked to reserve a spot for posterity to see what the old North Woods looked like, he likely would have chosen the Flambeau, for here the cream of the white pine grew on the same acres with the cream of the sugar maple, yellow birch, and hemlock. This rich intermixture of pine and hardwoods was and is uncommon. The Flambeau pines, growing on a hardwood soil richer than pines are ordinarily able to occupy, were so large and valuable, and so close to a good log-driving stream, that they were cut at an early day, as evidenced by the decayed condition of their giant stumps. Only defective pines were spared, but there are enough of these alive today to punctuate the skyline of the Flambeau with many a green monument to bygone days. The hardwood logging came much later. In fact, the last big hardwood company pulled steel on its last logging railroad only a decade ago. All that remains of that company today is a land office in its ghost town, selling off its cutovers to hopeful settlers. Thus died an epic in American history, the epic of cut-out and get-out. Like a coyote rummaging in the offal of a deserted camp, the post-logging economy of the Flambeau subsists on the leavings of its own past. Gippo pulpwood cutters nose around in the slashings for the occasional small hemlock overlooked in the main logging. A portable sawmill crew dredges the riverbed for sunken deadheads, many of which drowned during the hell-for-leather log drives of the glory days. Rows of these mud-stained corpses are drawn up on shore at the old landings, all in perfect condition and some of great value, for no such pine exists in the North Woods today. Post and pole cutters strip the swamps of white cedar. The deer follow them around and strip the felled tops of their foliage. Everybody and everything subsists on leavings. So complete are all these scavengings that when the modern cottager builds a log cabin, he uses imitation logs sawed out of slab piles in Idaho or Oregon, hauled to Wisconsin woods in a freight car. The proverbial coals to Newcastle seem a mild irony compared with this. Yet there remains the river, in a few spots hardly changed since Paul Bunyan's day. At early dawn, before the motorboats awaken, one can still hear it singing in the wilderness. There are a few sections of uncut timber, luckily state-owned. And there is a considerable remnant of wildlife, muskellunge, bass, and sturgeon in the river, mergansers, black ducks, and wood ducks breeding in the sloughs, ospreys, eagles, and ravens cruising overhead. Everywhere are deer, perhaps too many. I counted 52 in 2 days afloat. A wolf or two still roams the upper Flambeau, and there is a trapper who claims he saw a marten, though no marten skin has come out of the Flambeau since 1900. Using these remnants of the wilderness as a nucleus, the State Conservation Department began, in 1943, to rebuild a 50-mile stretch of river as a wild area for the use and enjoyment of young Wisconsin. This wild stretch is set in a matrix of state forest, but there is to be no forestry on the riverbanks, and as few road crossings as possible. Slowly, patiently, and sometimes expensively, the Conservation Department has been buying land, removing cottages, warding off unnecessary roads, and in general, pushing the clock back, as far as possible, toward the original wilderness. The good soil that enabled the Flambeau to grow the best cork pine for Paul Bunyan likewise enabled Rusk County, during recent decades, to sprout a dairy industry. These dairy farmers wanted cheaper electric power than that offered by local power companies. Hence, they organized a cooperative REA, and in 1947, applied for a power dam, which, when built, would clip off the lower reaches of a 50-mile stretch in process of restoration as canoe water. There was a sharp and bitter political fight. The legislature, sensitive to farmer pressure, but oblivious of wilderness values, not only approved the REA dam, but deprived the Conservation Commission of any future voice in the disposition of power sites. It thus seems likely that the remaining canoe water on the Flambeau, as well as every other stretch of wild river in the state, will ultimately be harnessed for power. Perhaps our grandsons, having never seen a wild river, will never miss the chance to set a canoe in singing waters. Deadening. The old oak had been girdled and was dead. There are degrees of death in abandoned farms. Some old houses cock an eye at you, as if to say, "Somebody will move in. Wait and see." But this farm was different. Girdling the old oak to squeeze one last crop out of the barnyard has the same finality as burning the furniture to keep warm. Illinois and Iowa. Illinois bus ride. A farmer and his son are out in the yard, pulling a cross-cut saw through the innards of an ancient cottonwood. The tree is so large and so old that only a foot of blade is left to pull on. Time was when that tree was a buoy in the prairie sea. George Rogers Clark may have camped under it. Buffalo may have nooned in its shade, switching flies. Every spring it roosted fluttering pigeons. It is the best historical library short of the State College, but once a year it sheds cotton on the farmers' window screens. Of these two facts, only the second is important. The State College tells farmers that Chinese elms do not clog screens, and hence are preferable to cottonwoods. It likewise pontificates on cherry preserves, Bang's disease, hybrid corn, and beautifying the farm home. The only thing it does not know about farms is where they came from. Its job is to make Illinois safe for soybeans. I am sitting in a 60-mile-an-hour bus, sailing over a highway originally laid out for horse and buggy. The ribbon of concrete has been widened and widened until the field fences threaten to topple into the road cuts. In the narrow thread of sod between the shaved banks and the toppling fences grow the relics of what once was Illinois, the prairie. No one in the bus sees these relics. A worried farmer, his fertilizer bill projecting from his shirt pocket, looks blankly at the lupins, Lespedizas, or baptisias, that originally pumped nitrogen out of the prairie air and into his black, loamy acres. He does not distinguish them from the parvenu quackgrass in which they grow. Were I to ask him why his corn makes 100 bushels, while that of non-prairie states does well to make 30, he would probably answer that Illinois soil is better. Were I to ask him the name of that white spike of pea-like flowers hugging the fence, he would shake his head. A weed, likely. A cemetery flashes by, its borders alight with prairie pocoons. There are no pocoons elsewhere. Dog fennels and sow thistles supply the yellow motif for the modern landscape. Pocoons converse only with the dead. Through the open window, I hear the heart-stirring whistle of an upland plover. Time was when his forebears followed the buffalo as they trudged shoulder-deep through an illimitable garden of forgotten blooms. A boy spies the bird and remarks to his father, "There goes a snipe." The sign says, "You are entering the Green River Soil Conservation District." In smaller type is a list of who is cooperating. The letters are too small to be read from a moving bus. It must be a roster of who's who in conservation. The sign is neatly painted. It stands in a creek-bottom pasture so short you could play golf on it. Nearby is the graceful loop of an old, dry creek bed. The new creek bed is ditched straight as a ruler. It has been uncurled by the county engineer to hurry the runoff. On the hill in the background are contoured strip crops. They have been curled by the erosion engineer to retard the runoff. The water must be confused by so much advice. Everything on this farm spells money in the bank. The farmstead abounds in fresh paint, steel, and concrete. A date on the barn commemorates the founding fathers. The roof bristles with lightning rods. The weathercock is proud with new gilt. Even the pigs look solvent. The old oaks in the woodlot are without issue. There are no hedges, brush patches, fence rows, or other signs of shiftless husbandry. The cornfield has fat steers, but probably no quail. The fences stand on narrow ribbons of sod. Whoever plowed that close to barbed wires must have been saying, "Waste not, want not." In the creek bottom pasture, flood trash is lodged high in the bushes. The creek banks are raw. Chunks of Illinois have sloughed off and moved seaward. Patches of giant ragweed mark where freshets have thrown down the silt they could not carry. Just who is solvent? For how long? The highway stretches like a taut tape across the corn, oats, and clover fields. The bus ticks off the opulent miles. The passengers talk and talk and talk. About what? About baseball, taxes, sons-in-law, movies, motors, and funerals. But never about the heaving groundswell of Illinois that washes the windows of the speeding bus. Illinois has no genesis, no history, no shoals or deeps, no tides of life and death. To them, Illinois is only the sea on which they sail to ports unknown. Red legs kicking. When I call to mind my earliest impressions, I wonder whether the process ordinarily referred to as growing up is not actually a process of growing down. Whether experience, so much touted among adults as the thing children lack, is not actually a progressive dilution of the essentials by the trivialities of living. This much at least is sure. My earliest impressions of wildlife and its pursuit retain a vivid sharpness of form and color and atmosphere that half a century of professional wildlife experience has failed to obliterate or to improve upon. Like most aspiring hunters, I was given, at an early age, a single-barreled shotgun and permission to hunt rabbits. One winter Saturday, en route to my favorite rabbit patch, I noticed that the lake, then covered with ice and snow, had developed a small air hole at a point where a windmill discharged warm water from the shore. All ducks had long since departed southward, but I then and there formulated my first ornithological hypothesis. If there were a duck left in the region, he or she would inevitably, sooner or later, drop in at this air hole. I suppressed my appetite for rabbits, then no mean feat, sat down in the cold smart weeds on the frozen mud, and waited. I waited all afternoon, growing colder with each passing crow and with each rheumatic groan of the laboring windmill. Finally, at sunset, a lone black duck came out of the west, and without even a preliminary circling of the air hole, set his wings and pitched downward. I cannot remember the shot. I remember only my unspeakable delight when my first duck hit the snowy ice with a thud and lay there, belly up, red legs kicking. When my father gave me the shotgun, he said I might hunt partridges with it, but that I might not shoot them from trees. I was old enough, he said, to learn wing shooting. My dog was good at treeing partridge, and to forego a sure shot in the tree in favor of a hopeless one at the fleeting bird was my first exercise in ethical codes. Compared with a treed partridge, the devil and his seven kingdoms was a mild temptation. At the end of my second season of featherless partridge hunting, I was walking one day through an aspen thicket when a big partridge rose with a roar at my left, and, towering over the aspens, crossed behind me, hell-bent for the nearest cedar swamp. It was a swinging shot of the sort the partridge hunter dreams about, and the bird tumbled dead in a shower of feathers and golden leaves. I could draw a map today of each clump of red bunchberry and each blue aster that adorned the mossy spot where he lay, my first partridge on the wing. I suspect my present affection for bunchberries and asters dates from that moment. Arizona and New Mexico. On top. When I first lived in Arizona, the White Mountain was a horseman's world. Except along a few main routes, it was too rough for wagons. There were no cars. It was too big for foot travel. Even sheepherders rode. Thus, by elimination, the county-sized plateau known as On Top was the exclusive domain of the mounted man, mounted cowman, mounted sheepman, mounted forest officer, mounted trapper, and those unclassified mounted men of unknown origin and uncertain destination, always found on frontiers. It is difficult for this generation to understand this aristocracy of space based upon transport. No such thing existed in the railroad towns 2 days to the north, where you had your choice of travel by shoe leather, burro, cow horse, buckboard, freight wagon, caboose, or pullman. Each of these modes of movement corresponded to a social caste, the members of which spoke a distinctive vernacular, wore distinctive clothes, ate distinctive food, and patronized different saloons. Their only common denominator was a democracy of debt to the general store, and a communal wealth of Arizona dust and Arizona sunshine. As one proceeded southward across the plains and mesas toward the White Mountain, these castes dropped out one by one as their respective modes of travel became impossible, until finally, On Top, the horseman ruled the world. Henry Ford's revolution has, of course, abolished all this. Today, the plain has given even the sky to Tom, Dick, and Harry. In winter, the top of the mountain was denied even to horsemen, for the snow piled deep on the high meadows, and the little canyons up which the only trails ascended drifted full to the brim. In May, every canyon roared with an icy torrent, but soon thereafter you could top out if your horse had the heart to climb half a day through knee-deep mud. In the little village at the foot of the mountain, there existed, each spring, a tacit competition to be the first rider to invade the high solitudes. Many of us tried it, for reasons we did not stop to analyze. Rumor ran fast. Whoever did it first wore a kind of horseman's halo. He was man of the year. The mountain spring, storybooks to the contrary notwithstanding, did not come with a rush. Balmy days alternated with bitter winds, even after the sheep had gone up. I have seen few colder sights than a drab gray mountain meadow, sprinkled with complaining ewes and half-frozen lambs, pelted by hail and snow. Even the gay nutcrackers humped their backs to these spring storms. The mountain in summer had as many moods as there were days and weathers. The dullest rider, as well as his horse, felt these moods to the marrow of his bones. On a fair morning, the mountain invited you to get down and roll in its new grass and flowers. Your less inhibited horse did just this if you failed to keep a tight rein. Every living thing sang, chirped, and burgeoned. Massive pines and firs, storm-tossed these many months, soaked up the sun in towering dignity. Tasseled-eared squirrels, poker-faced but exuding emotion with voice and tail, told you insistently what you already knew full well, that never had there been so rare a day or so rich a solitude to spend it in. An hour later, thunderheads may have blotted out the sun, while your erstwhile paradise cowered under the impending lash of lightning, rain, and hail. Black gloom hung poised, as over a bomb with the fuse lighted. Your horse jumped at every rolling pebble, every crackling twig. When you turned in the saddle to unlash your slicker, he shied, snorted, and trembled, as if you were about to unfurl the scroll of an apocalypse. When I hear anyone say he does not fear lightning, I still remark inwardly, he has never ridden the mountain in July. The explosions are fearsome enough, but more so are the smoking slivers of stone that sing past your ear when the bolt crashes into a rimrock. Still more are the splinters that fly when a bolt explodes a pine. I remember one gleaming white one, 15 feet long, that stabbed deep into the earth at my feet and stood there humming like a tuning fork. It must be poor life that achieves freedom from fear. The top of the mountain was a great meadow, half a day's ride across. But do not picture it as a single amphitheater of grass, hedged in by a wall of pines. The edges of that meadow were scrolled, curled, and crenulated with an infinity of bays and coves, points and stringers, peninsulas and parks, each one of which differed from all the rest. No man knew them all, and every day's ride offered a gambler's chance of finding a new one. I say new because one often had the feeling, riding into some flower-spangled cove, that if anyone had ever been here before, he must of necessity have sung a song or written a poem. This feeling of having this day discovered the incredible accounts, perhaps, for the profusion of initials, dates, and cattle brands inscribed on the patient bark of aspens at every mountain campsite. In these inscriptions, one could, in any day, read the history of Homo Texanus and his culture, not in the cold categories of anthropology, but in terms of the individual career of some founding father, whose initials you recognized as the man whose son bested you at horse trading, or whose daughter you once danced with. Here, dated in the 90s, was his simple initial, without brand, inscribed, no doubt, when he first arrived alone on the mountain as an itinerant cowpuncher. Next, a decade later, his initial plus brand. By that time, he had become a solid citizen with an outfit, acquired by thrift, natural increase, and perhaps a nimble rope. Next, only a few years old, he found his daughter's initial, inscribed by some enamored youth aspiring not only to the lady's hand, but to the economic succession. The old man was dead now. In his later years, his heart had thrilled only to his bank account and to the tally of his flocks and herds. But the aspen revealed that in his youth, he too had felt the glory of the mountain spring. The history of the mountain was written not only in aspen bark, but in its place names. Cow country place names are lewd, humorous, ironic, or sentimental, but seldom trite. Usually, they are subtle enough to draw inquiry from new arrivals, whereby hangs that web of tales which, full spun, constitutes the local folklore. For example, there was the Boneyard, a lovely meadow where bluebells arched over the half-buried skulls and scattered vertebrae of cows long since dead. Here in the 1880s, a foolish cowman, newly arrived from the warm valleys of Texas, had trusted the allurements of the mountain summer and essayed to winter his herd on mountain hay. When the November storms hit, he and his horse had floundered out, but not his cows. Again, there was the Campbell Blue, a headwater of the Blue River, to which an early cowman had brought himself a bride. The lady, tiring of rocks and trees, had yearned for a piano. A piano was duly fetched, a Campbell piano. There was only one mule in the county capable of packing it, and only one packer capable of the almost superhuman task of balancing such a load. But the piano failed to bring contentment. The lady decamped, and when the story was told me, the ranch cabin was already a ruin of sagging logs. Again there was Frijole Cienega, a marshy meadow walled in by pines, under which stood, in my day, a small log cabin used by any passer-by as an overnight camp. It was the unwritten law for the owner of such real estate to leave flour, lard, and beans, and for the passer-by to replenish such stock as he could. But one luckless traveler, trapped there for a week by storms, had found only beans. This breach of hospitality was sufficiently notable to be handed down to history as a place name. Finally, there was Paradise Ranch, an obvious platitude when read from a map, but something quite different when you arrived there at the end of a hard ride. It lay tucked away on the far side of a high peak, as any proper paradise should. Through its verdant meadows meandered a singing trout stream. A horse left for a month on this meadow waxed so fat that rainwater gathered in a pool on his back. After my first visit to Paradise Ranch, I remarked to myself, "What else could you call it?" Despite several opportunities to do so, I have never returned to the White Mountain. I prefer not to see what tourists, roads, sawmills, and logging railroads have done for it or to it. I hear young people, not yet born when I first rode out on top, exclaim about it as a wonderful place. To this, with an unspoken mental reservation, I agree. Thinking like a mountain. A deep, chesty ball echoes from rimrock to rimrock, rolls down the mountain, and fades into the far blackness of the night. It is an outburst of wild, defiant sorrow, and of contempt for all the adversities of the world. Every living thing, and perhaps many a dead one as well, pays heed to that call. To the deer, it is a reminder of the way of all flesh. To the pine, a forecast of midnight scuffles and of blood upon the snow. To the coyote, a promise of gleanings to come. To the cowman, a thread of red ink at the bank. To the hunter, a challenge of fang against bullet. Yet behind these obvious and immediate hopes and fears, there lies a deeper meaning, known only to the mountain itself. Only the mountain has lived long enough to listen objectively to the howl of a wolf. Those unable to decipher the hidden meaning know nevertheless that it is there, for it is felt in all wolf country, and distinguishes that country from all other land. It tingles in the spine of all who hear wolves by night, or who scan their tracks by day. Even without sight or sound of wolf, it is implicit in 100 small events. The midnight whinny of a pack horse, the rattle of rolling rocks, the bound of a fleeing deer, the way shadows lie under the spruces. Only the ineducable tyro can fail to sense the presence or absence of wolves, or the fact that mountains have a secret opinion about them. My own conviction on this score dates from the day I saw a wolf die. We were eating lunch on a high rimrock, at the foot of which a turbulent river elbowed its way. We saw what we thought was a doe fording the torrent, her breast awash in whitewater. When she climbed the bank toward us and shook out her tail, we realized our error. It was a wolf. A half dozen others, evidently grown pups, sprang from the willows and all joined in a welcoming melee of wagging tails and playful maulings. What was literally a pile of wolves writhed and tumbled in the center of an open flat at the foot of our rimrock. In those days, we had never heard of passing up a chance to kill a wolf. In a second, we were pumping lead into the pack, but with more excitement than accuracy. How to aim a steep downhill shot is always confusing. When our rifles were empty, the old wolf was down, and a pup was dragging a leg in impassable slide rocks. We reached the old wolf in time to watch a fierce green fire dying in her eyes. I realized then, and have known ever since, that there was something new to me in those eyes, something known only to her and to the mountain. I was young then, and full of trigger itch. I thought that because fewer wolves meant more deer, that no wolves would mean hunter's paradise. But after seeing the green fire die, I sensed that neither the wolf nor the mountain agreed with such a view. Since then, I have lived to see state after state extirpate its wolves. I have watched the face of many a newly wolfless mountain, and seen the south-facing slopes wrinkle with a maze of new deer trails. I have seen every edible bush and seedling browsed, first to anemic desuetude, and then to death. I have seen every edible tree defoliated to the height of a saddle horn. Such a mountain looks as if someone had given God a new pruning shears, and forbidden him all other exercise. In the end, the starved bones of the hoped-for deer herd, dead of its own too much, bleach with the bones of the dead sage, or molder under the high-lined junipers. I now suspect that just as a deer herd lives in mortal fear of its wolves, so does a mountain live in mortal fear of its deer. And perhaps with better cause, for while a buck pulled down by wolves can be replaced in 2 or 3 years, a range pulled down by too many deer may fail of replacement in as many decades. So also with cows. The cowman who cleans his range of wolves does not realize that he is taking over the wolf's job of trimming the herd to fit the range. He has not learned to think like a mountain. Hence we have dust bowls and rivers washing the future into the sea. We all strive for safety, prosperity, comfort, long life, and dullness. The deer strives with his supple legs, the cowman with trap and poison, the statesman with pen, the most of us with machines, votes, and dollars, but it all comes to the same thing, peace in our time. A measure of success in this is all well enough, and perhaps is a requisite to objective thinking. But too much safety seems to yield only danger in the long run. Perhaps this is behind Thoreau's dictum, "In wildness is the salvation of the world." Perhaps this is the hidden meaning in the howl of the wolf, long known among mountains, but seldom perceived among men. Escadilla. Life in Arizona was bounded underfoot by grama grass, overhead by sky, and on the horizon by Escadilla. To the north of the mountain, you rode on honey-colored plains. Look up anywhere, anytime, and you saw Escadilla. To the east, you rode over a confusion of wooded mesas. Each hollow seemed its own small world, soaked in sun, fragrant with juniper, and cozy with the chatter of pinyon jays. But top out on a ridge, and you at once become a speck in an immensity. On its edge hung Escadilla. To the south lay the tangled canyons of Blue River, full of whitetails, wild turkey, and wilder cattle. When you missed a saucy buck waving his goodbye over the skyline, and looked down your sights to wonder why, you looked at a far blue mountain, Escadilla. To the west billowed the outliers of the Apache National Forest. We cruised timber there, converting the tall pines, 40 by 40, into notebook figures representing hypothetical lumber piles. Panting up a canyon, the cruiser felt a curious incongruity between the remoteness of his notebook symbols and the immediacy of sweaty fingers, locust thorns, deer fly bites, and scolding squirrels. But on the next ridge, a cold wind, roaring across a green sea of pines, blew his doubts away. On the far shore hung Escadilla. The mountain bounded not only our work and our play, but even our attempts to get a good dinner. On winter evenings, we often tried to ambush a mallard on the river flats. The wary flocks circled the rosy west, the steel blue north, and then disappeared into the inky black of Escadilla. If they reappeared on set wings, we had a fat drake for the Dutch oven. If they failed to reappear, it was bacon and beans again. There was, in fact, only one place from which you did not see Escadilla on the skyline. That was the top of Escadilla itself. Up there you could not see the mountain, but you could feel it. The reason was the Big Bear. Old Bigfoot was a robber baron, and Escadilla was his castle. Each spring, when the warm winds had softened the shadows on the snow, the old grizzly crawled out of his hibernation den in the rock slides and, descending the mountain, bashed in the head of a cow. Eating his fill, he climbed back to his crags, and there summered peaceably on marmots, conies, berries, and roots. I once saw one of his kills. The cow's skull and neck were pulp, as if she had collided head-on with a fast freight. No one ever saw the old bear, but in the muddy springs about the base of the cliffs, you saw his incredible tracks. Seeing them made the most hard-bitten cowboys aware of bear. Wherever they rode, they saw the mountain, and when they saw the mountain, they thought of bear. Campfire conversation ran to beef, biles, and bear. Bigfoot claimed for his own only a cow a year, and a few square miles of useless rocks, but his personality pervaded the county. Those were the days when Progress first came to the cow country. Progress had various emissaries. One was the first transcontinental automobilist. The cowboys understood this breaker of roads. He talked the same breezy bravado as any breaker of broncos. They did not understand, but they listened to and looked at the pretty lady in black velvet who came to enlighten them, in a Boston accent, about woman's suffrage. They marveled, too, at the telephone engineer who strung wires on the junipers and brought instantaneous messages from town. An old man asked whether the wire could bring him a side of bacon. One spring, Progress sent still another emissary, a government trapper, a sort of St. George in overalls, seeking dragons to slay at government expense. Were there, he asked, any destructive animals in need of slaying? Yes, there was the big bear. The trapper packed his mule and headed for Escadilla. In a month he was back, his mule staggering under a heavy hide. There was only one barn in town big enough to dry it on. He had tried traps, poison, and all his usual wiles to no avail. Then he had erected a set gun in a defile through which only the bear could pass, and waited. The last grizzly walked into the string and shot himself. It was June. The pelt was foul, patchy, and worthless. It seemed to us rather an insult to deny the last grizzly the chance to leave a good pelt as a memorial to his race. All he left was a skull in the National Museum, and a quarrel among scientists over the Latin name of the skull. It was only after we pondered on these things that we began to wonder who wrote the rules for Progress. Since the beginning, time had gnawed at the basaltic hulk of Escadilla, wasting, waiting, and building. Time built three things on the old mountain: a venerable aspect, a community of minor animals and plants, and a grizzly. The government trapper who took the grizzly knew he had made Escadilla safe for cows. He did not know he had toppled the spire off an edifice of building since the morning stars sang together. The bureau chief who sent the trapper was a biologist versed in the architecture of evolution, but he did not know that spires might be as important as cows. He did not foresee that within 2 decades the cow country would become tourist country, and as such have greater need of bears than of beefsteaks. The congressmen who voted money to clear the ranges of bears were the sons of pioneers. They acclaimed the superior virtues of the frontiersmen, but they strove with might and main to make an end of the frontier. We forest officers, who acquiesced in the extinguishment of the bear, knew a local rancher who had plowed up a dagger engraved with the name of one of Coronado's captains. We spoke harshly of the Spaniards, who, in their zeal for gold and converts, had needlessly extinguished the native Indians. It did not occur to us that we, too, were the captains of an invasion too sure of its own righteousness. Escadilla still hangs on the horizon, but when you see it, you no longer think of bear. It's only a mountain now. Chihuahua and Sonora. Guacamaja. The physics of beauty is one department of natural science still in the Dark Ages. Not even the manipulators of bent space have tried to solve its equations. Everybody knows, for example, that the autumn landscape in the North Woods is the land, plus a red maple, plus a ruffed grouse. In terms of conventional physics, the grouse represents only a millionth of either the mass or the energy of an acre. Yet subtract the grouse, and the whole thing is dead. An enormous amount of some kind of motive power has been lost. It is easy to say that the loss is all in our mind's eye, but is there any sober ecologist who will agree? He knows full well that there has been an ecological death, the significance of which is inexpressible in terms of contemporary science. A philosopher has called this imponderable essence the noumenon of material things. It stands in contradistinction to phenomenon, which is ponderable and predictable. even to the tossings and turnings of the remotest star. The grouse is the noumenon of the north woods, the blue jay of the hickory groves, the whiskey jack of the muskegs, the pinionero of the juniper foothills. Ornithological texts do not record these facts. I suppose they are new to science, however obvious to the discerning scientist. Be that as it may, I here record the discovery of the noumenon of the Sierra Madre, the thick-billed parrot. He is a discovery only because so few have visited his haunts. Once there, only the deaf and blind could fail to perceive his role in the mountain life and landscape. Indeed, you have hardly finished breakfast before the chattering flocks leave their roost on the rim rocks and perform a sort of morning drill in the high reaches of the dawn. Like squadrons of cranes, they wheel and spiral, loudly debating with each other the question, which also puzzles you, whether this new day which creeps slowly over the canyons is bluer and golder than its predecessors, or less so. The vote being a draw, they repair, by separate companies, to the high mesas for their breakfast of pine seed on the half-shell. They have not yet seen you. But a little later, as you begin the steep ascent out of the canyon, some sharp-eyed parrot, perhaps a mile away, espies this strange creature puffing up the trail where only deer or lion, bear or turkey, is licensed to travel. Breakfast is forgotten. With a whoop and a shout, the whole gang is a-wing and coming at you. As they circle overhead, you wish fervently for a parrot dictionary. Are they demanding what the devil business have you in these parts? Or are they, like an avian chamber of commerce, merely making sure you appreciate the glories of their hometown, its weather, its citizens, and its glorious future as compared with any and all other times and places whatsoever? It might be either or both. And there flashes through your mind the sad premonition of what will happen when the road is built, and this riotous reception committee first greets the tourist with a gun. It is soon clear that you are a dull, inarticulate fellow, unable to respond by so much as a whistle to the standard amenities of the Sierra Morn. And after all, there are more pine cones in the woods than have yet been opened. So let's finish breakfast. This time they may settle upon some tree below the rimrock, giving you the chance to sneak out to the edge and look down. There, for the first time, you see color, velvet-green uniforms with scarlet and yellow epaulets and black helmets, sweeping noisily from pine to pine, but always in formation and always in even numbers. Only once did I see a gang of five, or any other number not comprised of pairs. I do not know whether the nesting pairs are as noisy as these roistering flocks that greeted me in September. I do know that in September, if there are parrots on the mountain, you will soon know it. As a proper ornithologist, I should doubtless try to describe the call. It superficially resembles that of the pinion jay, but the music of the pinioneros is as soft and nostalgic as the haze hanging in their native canyons, while that of the guacamaja is louder and full of the salty enthusiasm of high comedy. In spring, I am told, the pair hunts up a woodpecker hole in some tall dead pine and performs its racial duty in temporary isolation. But what woodpecker excavates a hole large enough? The guacamaja, as the natives euphoniously call the parrot, is as big as a pigeon, and hardly to be squeezed into a flicker loft. Does he, with his own powerful beak, perform the necessary enlargement? Or is he dependent on the holes of the imperial woodpecker, which is said to occur in these parts? To some future ornithological visitor, I bequeath the pleasant task of discovering the answer. The Green Lagoons. It is the part of wisdom never to revisit a wilderness, for the more golden the lily, the more certain that someone has gilded it. To return not only spoils a trip, but tarnishes a memory. It is only in the mind that shining adventure remains forever bright. For this reason, I have never gone back to the delta of the Colorado since my brother and I explored it by canoe in 1922. For all we could tell, the delta had lain forgotten since Hernando de Alarcón led